Excuse me, your recording has started. Please proceed.
Thank you very much. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to everyone. Welcome to the IGO-INGO Curative Rights Protection Mechanism meeting held on Thursday, 8th of September 2016 at 1700 UTC. On the call today, we have George Pitikos, Peter Winsford, Phil Corwin, Jay Chapman, Paul Patterfield, and Mason Cole. We have received an apology from David Maher, and from staff we have Mary Wong, Steve Chan, Barry Cobb, Dennis Chan, and myself, Yishim Nazar. Finally, I would like to remind everyone to state their names before speaking for the transcript purposes. And over to you, Phil. Thank you very much.
Well, this is Phil. For the record, good morning, good afternoon, good evening to our participants. And a particular welcome back to Steve Chan. Steve is, we're told, making very good recovery from some recent eye surgery and is now back on the job. So we're delighted that everything went well with that. Are there any revisions to statements of interest before we get into the meat of the matter here today? Okay, hearing none, we're going to be spending most of this meeting on agenda topic two, which is initial discussion of the draft text proposed for section six, which is the key section of the draft report and recommendations we'll be developing and submitting for community comment. This is, of course, the result, our findings and recommendations as a result of our work over the past 2 years. Okay, and we just got that unscrolled, so we can scroll through that. What I would suggest we do today, and let's hear if there's any objections. This draft of Section 6 consists of recommendations and explanatory language regarding why we reach these recommendations, and I would propose that we start today, and this is what the co-chairs have done so far, is focus just on the recommendations. There's no point getting into a deep dive on the explanatory language unless we're all have a consensus on the recommendations we're teeing up here. So I propose we proceed that way. I think that'll give us plenty to discuss. So any comment on that procedural matter of proposing that we proceed today by focusing on the draft recommendations in this draft section and then get into the explanatory language for each of them, probably at a later call, because I think just going over those recommendations will probably take up most of today's call, or all of it. I see some check marks and some supportive language in the chat room, so I'm going to proceed in that manner. So let's start with recommendation one. Seems like a good place to start, which is our recommendation that no changes to the UDRP and URS be made and no specific new process be created for INGOs, that's international non-governmental organizations, including the Red Cross Movement and the International Olympic Committee, and to the extent that the policy guidance document referred to elsewhere in this set of recommendations is compiled, the working group recommends that this clarification as regard INGOs be included in that document. So let's open the floor for discussion of recommendation one. And just let me say, I'll call on Petter in a sec. As committee working group members should recall, we actually went back to the council at one point and asked for and got an approved revision of our charter, taking INGOs out because we had reached this conclusion fairly early on in our work. So, Petter, go ahead.
Thanks, Petter, for there. Just a quick note that I think this, as it is written today is a perfect summary of what we have concluded earlier in our work. So I personally see no reason to make any further changes. It's a very good summary of what we concluded during our work. Thanks.
Okay, thank you for that comment, Peter. See, George and Jay have come in the chat room that they approve of the current language of Recommendation 1. Anyone else want to speak to Recommendation 1 before we close out discussion of the basic recommendation? In a later call, we will address the explanatory language around that. Okay. Seeing no hands up and no requests and hearing no one on the phone line. By the way, is there anyone on the phone line who's not in the chat room? I guess not. Okay. So.
Hello, Trying to unmute. There is no one just on the conference line. Everyone is on the AC as well.
Okay, great. Okay. Okay, recommendation 2. We're going to spend a little time on this, and I'm going to provide some background and we get into it. Recommendation 2, for IGO standing to file a complaint under the UDP and URS, can, in addition to trademark rights, and I think the red language or orange language, at least that's what it is in my display, is language that I added in an initial review of this. Is that correct, Mary, that the red stuff is my suggested changes? Yeah, okay, Mary Apreed in the chat room. Yeah, and I've only had a chance to go through the recommendations, not the full text of this entire draft so far. That in addition to trademark rights be demonstrated by IGOs have complied with the requisite communication and notification procedure in accordance with Article 6 tier of the Paris Convention for the Protection of Industrial Property. For clarity, the working group recommends further that a policy guidance document pursuant to the UDRP and URS be prepared and issued to this effect for the benefit of panelists. And there's a comment from staff there, from Mary. Staff has some misgivings about this recommendation. Mary, rather than you elaborating, let me, I do have your email that you sent to the co-chairs. I'd like to address that in a personal capacity and kind of tee up the issue for working group discussion. And in a email sent yesterday by Mary to the co-chair, she outlined the four reasons for staff concerns on this. I'm going to go through them and indicate my own personal views on this. And again, my personal view is I'm comfortable for where, personally comfortable where we're coming out with this draft recommendation. And if we don't have a consensus on this recommendation, it means that we would essentially be requiring that for standing, the only way IGOs could have standing would be to show a trademark in the name or acronym that they're addressing through the curative rights process. First, staff noted that an Article 6 tier communication to WIPO simply means that an IGO is notified its name, its acronym to WIPO. It doesn't mean that all member states have automatically agreed that be recognized as an IGO name or acronym for purposes of the Paris Convention protections. States have 12 months to file an objection to a notification, and each state has its own sovereign discretion as to how to implement the Article 6 tier protection. My personal reaction on that is that, excuse my throat, my hoarseness, that enough, and this we'll get into this in a second, that enough states do automatically agree, since you only need one trademark registration in any nation to assert a right to file a in an ICANN-approved CRP, I think it's sufficient and it's sufficiently related. While it's not identical to the rights conferred by a trademark registration. It is a right, a protective right within the trademark system. For me personally, that's close enough to justify standing. Staff's next point was that there's a disparate handling of six-tier notifications among Paris member states. Some member countries automatically accept the notifications, and I'll stop there and note that that would mean that at least some member countries automatically accept the registration with WIPO is sufficient to confer the Article 6-tier protections. Staff note goes on, other member countries perform a review process to determine whether to accept them. My impression is that the vast majority accept most of these, that it's a rarity for states to reject an Article 6-tier notice to WIPO. Staff is concerned that it would be awkward to conclude that a six-tier notification by itself would be equivalent to fulfilling the UDRP-URS standing requirement in all cases, much less if such procedural notification creates an enforceable right equivalent or similar to trademark rights. Again, speaking personally, it's not equivalent. We'll stipulate for that the record, but it is a protective right within the trademark regime of the signatory countries to the Paris Convention and in WTO nations. It's a protective right within their national trademark system. So I'm comfortable with having that as grounds for standing. Third point that staff raised, while we're only talking about remedies under UPRS, UDRP and URS, this may set a precedent for us going down a slippery slope of allowing these standing rights to be expanded, that it might drag in the geographic indicators issue. Speaking personally, I'm always leery of proceeding down slippery slopes, but protection for IGO names and acronyms is something that we've gotten very strong advice from the GAC on this point, that they want to see better protections, whereas the GAC has not been able to reach protection on geographic indicators. So for me, that's sufficient differentiation to be comfortable with this. And then fourth point related to historical documentation about Article 6-tier, and in particular, there's a quote here that the purpose of Article 6-tier is not to protect the official signs or hallmarks mentioned above as subjects of industrial property, but rather to exclude them from becoming such subjects in certain circumstances. So, yeah, the purpose is somewhat different from trademark rights, again, speaking personally, but it is a protection, again, within trademark regimes. So I've now conveyed to the full group the discrete concerns raised by staff. I see Petters hand up, and we're going to open up recommendation two now for general comment on the recommendation that Article 6-tier registration be sufficient to confer standing, and also to address, if anybody wants to, any of the concerns about this potential recommendation raised by staff. Go ahead, Petter.
Thanks. Just wanted to say that I agree with your comments and replies when it comes to the IGOs and Article 6 there. We need to have in mind that it's only the first step of the dispute resolution procedure we're talking about, namely to identify if the complainant has any kind of name rights. And as you said, compared to trademark rights that you raise in the UDRP, it could be a registration in a very small country in a faraway part of the world, but it's still enough to show that you have trademark rights. And then it's up to the parties to convince the panelists on their next two steps. When it comes to IGOs, it is the same. You can we, in this way, with Article 60, we have at least identified some kind of name rights, making it acceptable that the complainant start a procedure. And then it's up to the complainant also to show the bad faith steps. So I think that Article 60 is, it's better than to do nothing for IGOs, and it's a fair way to solve the problem that we identified in an early stage. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Peter, and I agree with you on those points you just made. I also, at this time, I note that Lori Shulman is online. I don't know if Lori heard my full exposition on this recommendation number 2 and some staff concerns about it, but welcome, Lori. I also note that George Kirikos filed in the chat room a reference to UDRP rules, that the reference to under applicable law could be referenced as further buttressing standing from Article 6 tier registration. And I would also say that on the slippery slope, when we get around to working on the actual explanatory language in this draft report, we should make it very clear that our views on this relate only to the unique circumstances of Article 6 tier and should not be taken as precedent for any assertion that any other rights out there, including geographic indicators, would trigger such standing. So obviously, if someone has a trademark registration in a country that recognizes that, that's a different issue for the panelists to deal with. But do we have further discussion on Article 2? There's an important recommendation. It's the one that explicitly provides standing for IGOs in the UDRP and URS based on Article 6 tier registration. So if we have views on this, let's hear them now. George?
George Kirikos for the transcript. I noticed that at the very end of the recommendation, it says for the benefit of panelists. Should we perhaps amend that slightly to also make it clear that it's also for the benefit of potential complainants? So that the IGOs themselves are educated on that point? It's kind of like indirectly saying that already, but...
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that, George, and that was just... when I inserted that phrase, you know, I have no author's pride in changing that or expanding that. I just wanted to make clear that we wanted that policy guidance to go to the dispute resolution providers so that their panelists are informed on this point if this becomes something that's adopted down the road by in a final report that's adopted by the board. Okay, any further discussion on Recommendation 2? Okay, seeing no hands and hearing no voices, we're going to scroll down to number 3. Okay. Still trying to get to number 3.
On page 5.
Okay, I must have missed it. Oh, thank you. I went right past it. Okay. Recommendation 3. For IGOs, the working group does not recommend that any specific changes be made to the substantive grounds upon which a complainant may file and succeed on a claim against a respondent and then it references the applicable section of the UDRP. In relation to IGOs, however, the working group proposes that the limitation enshrined in Article 6, Tier 1C of the Paris Convention be considered an approximation of the remaining substantive grounds of the UDRP and URS with respect to the required findings that a respondent possess no legitimate rights in the domain name that is identical or confusingly similar to an IGO's name or acronym and has registered and used the domain name in question in bad faith. And then I had put in an initial comment on that we need to discuss a portion of that language more fully to consider its import and discuss whether it should be modified. And to do that, we're going to have to look at the actual text of the of Article 6 tier, because its description of the rights is similar to but somewhat different than the UDRP. So we're going to have to see if we need some conforming language there. So with that introduction, I open it to discussion on Recommendation 3. I hear someone typing. If that person could mute their phone, it would be appreciated. No discussion on this very important recommendation, which basically says that once the IGO has standing, they've got to show that the name or acronym that they've either trademarked or registered for protection under Article 6 tier is being essentially infringed by a domain registrant who registered and is using the name or acronym in bad faith. Yeah, I see some comments by George in the chair. Okay, I see your hand up, George. Go ahead.
George Grigos for the transcript. Yeah, I just want to reinforce Bill's argument and type the words from the Article 6, Tier 1C. Is that the language that you intend to capture, that the use or registration is probably not of such a nature as to mislead the public as to the existence of a connection between the user and the organization? Is that?
That sounds it, George, but I don't have the full text in front of me, so I wouldn't be in a position to say that's the only language in 6-tier, but we're going to have to focus on that as a group and see which language we're going to reference.
Yeah. Just to follow up, I agree that the recommendation number 3 as it stands is solid, so I'm in agreement.
Yeah, and I note that there's only right now one short paragraph of explanation for this recommendation, so we're probably going to want to flesh that out to be more extensive when we work on the full language of this section of the draft report. Okay. Is there other commentary on Recommendation 3, or is there the group basically satisfied? And, of course, we've never discussed making any changes in the substantive grounds for determining a UDRP or URS complaint. I'm not even sure that that's within the I think that's probably outside the scope of this working group to suggest that, but we're not suggesting that. We're just affirming that the grounds remain the same in terms of what the complainant has to prove to prevail. All right, seeing no hands, hearing none, no assertions, let's go on to Recommendation 4. And this will probably be the most controversial recommendation in terms of GAC and IGO reaction, potential reaction. Recommendation 4, in relation to the, and I'm going to read this, including placeholder language that I put in on initial review of the recommendations. So Recommendation 4, in relation to the issue of jurisdictional immunity, which IGOs may claim successfully in certain circumstances, but not ingos, close paren, The working group recommends that, A, no change be made to the mutual jurisdiction clause of the UDRP and URS, B, IGOs be notified that they have the ability to allow to have a complaint filed under the UDRP and or URS on their behalf by an agent or a licensee, such that, C, claims of jurisdictional immunity made by an IGO in respect of a particular jurisdiction will fall to be determined by the applicable laws of that jurisdiction. All right, and now continuing on to my placeholder language. Where an IGO succeeds in asserting its claim of jurisdictional immunity in a court of mutual jurisdiction, then, and I put in two options. Option one, the decision rendered against the registrant in the predecessor UDRP or URS shall be vitiated, or option two, the decision rendered against the registrant in the predecessor UDRP, and it should be, or URS, may be brought before the insert name of arbitration entity for de novo review and judgment. I'm going to come back and explain that after reading the last sentence. The working group recommends further that a policy guidance document be prepared and circulated to the Governmental Advisory Committee and the IGO representatives who have been active on this issue at ICANN that outlines the specific options available to IGOs who seek to suspend, cancel, or transfer a registrant's domain name. To explain the sentence I inserted, and then we'll open it to general comment, we dealt with two hypotheticals. One is that an IGO brings a UDRP or URS, the registrant prevails, the complainant fails and to meet their burden of proof, and the IGO complainant then exercises their option under either CRP to seek a de novo review in a court of mutual jurisdiction. By doing so, the IGO would have waived their sovereign immunity, clearly, by going to the court. So this issue doesn't come up there. The other hypothetical is IGO prevails as complainant, and domain registrant thinks that a mistake has been made by the panelist and exercises their right to go to a court of mutual jurisdiction. IGO then comes into that court and said, court, we have sovereign immunity, and we this proceeding should be stopped right now because you can't bring us before your court. You have no jurisdiction. And as we know from Professor Swain's memo, some courts will disagree, and the case will proceed. Some will agree, and the IGO will be dismissed out. In that second circumstance, the question is what happens to the registrant who lost the UDRP or URS? If that's the end of the story and if the decision of the panelist stands, they have no effective right of appeal. So we then have to decide whether in that circumstance we're going to give them a right to appeal to some arbitration group since they don't have a right of court appeal in a applicable mutual jurisdiction. So that's my explanation for the placeholder sentence. And this is the big issue, jurisdictional immunity. It's the one that stopped our work for a year while we went on a search to find a legal expert and then waited on Professor Swain's memo. And this is the one that we can anticipate some dissatisfaction with from the GAC and the IGOs. Particularly the IGOs. So, George, I see your hand up. Let's start a discussion on this recommendation. Thank you.
Sorry, I was muted. George Karikos for the transcripts. I like recommendation number four with option number one, though, not option number two. And as I mentioned in the chat, the reason why I prefer option number one is it more closely reflects what the status quo would be if the UDRP actually never existed. Like what would happen would be that the IGO would waive its immunity, file a complaint in court, and you know things would just go on as if it was a normal complainant. Option number two creates problems, and Laurie asked, what do I mean by gaming? Option number two, where you have to set up a separate tribunal process or arbitration process, it's kind of like we created our own problem by having them have the option of using the UDRP in the first place. And so we're creating a solution for our own problem. And in creating that kind of solution, we're like basically creating a whole new law and a whole new kind of gaming procedure where the complainant uses the UDRP in order to avoid waiving its immunity, which it would have to, you know, do by definition if the UDRP didn't exist. So that's my reasoning that, you know, imagine the UDRP never existed in the first place. What would happen? And then we shouldn't be creating new law just because we created the UDRP. Like the whole reason the UDRP was created was as a complement to the law only if both sides agree, because they can obviously overturn it to the courts. Creating option number two means that the courts no longer have that jurisdiction, which is something that was not contemplated by the UDRP and shouldn't create our own mess by creating this, you know, supranational court that isn't accountable to national courts. And I'll leave the floor to others if they want to comment, or I know Jay had some comments.
Okay. I'm going to respond. This is in a devil's advocate position, not necessarily my personal views, but I can anticipate that if we go with option one, that the IGO response would be you've placed us in an impossible position between you've given us access to a CRP where if we assert our sincere belief in sovereign immunity, we could lose the benefit of the curative rights process, and essentially you're forcing us to either use the available remedy and thereby give up any claim to an immunity we think we have, and also that if the decision is vitiated, we have a right, whether it's a trademark right or a right under Article 6 tier, without an effective remedy. So I'm just, again, that's devil advocacy, but I think we can anticipate that. I see Ms. Shulman from INTA, and please enlighten us, Lori. Lori, go ahead. We're not hearing you. Lori is typing. Yeah, you may be on mute.
I know. I couldn't get off mute. I apologize.
Now you're off mute.
Yes, I'm on my iPhone. It locked, and it wouldn't unlock and get me out of mute, and I apologize. My Adobe Connect audio is not doing so great today.
Okay. Well, go ahead, Lori.
So I agree with the devil here. I am the devil, right? Maybe. I don't know. But I do agree that this argument in terms of option one becomes circular. And I think circumvents the whole task that we were put to in terms of figuring out what can we do, what should we do, what is right on both sides of the argument regarding what options IGOs may have. If we tell them they're going to be forced into the court system by the mere fact that they own a domain and now want to assert a right, I do think that's a problem. I'm much more comfortable with option two and recommending a fair way of arbitration. I think you still get to the issue of what happens on appeal, but I'd rather see that second step in there than just go with option one and not have that there.
Yeah, thank you, Lori. Let me point out that if there's any support for option two, we're going to have to do some more work on who would be a qualified arbitration group and under what rules they would proceed and who would pay for it. We've got Professor Swain's suggestion that if IGOs want an arbitration option, they're the ones who should pay for the domain registrant to participate in that. So there are unresolved issues in regard to option two. Let me say that we also have the option as a working group to lay out both possibilities in a draft report and ask for community feedback and then choose one for the final report. I know that's unusual, but I don't think it's outside permissibility. So, George and Lori, I assume those are old hands, so I'm going to call on Petter.
No. Oh, okay. No, I'll get back in the queue.
Did you have a quick follow-up? And then I can go to Petter.
Yeah, I do, because I am taking issue with this, and I believe it's a bias we've dealt with all along, and I understand where it comes from, that registrants don't want their names yanked arbitrarily. But I don't see that we see evidence of this, and I don't see that the volume of what we're talking about is creating that kind of issue from a public policy perspective. And so I am not comfortable with just, well, that's the reason, because registrants cannot be just have their property yanked at any time by the whim of an IGO. I don't think it's that simple. And I think this issue of due process is extremely complicated when it comes to governmental agencies. That's the issue in a nutshell. I mean, there's whole bodies of law in the U.S. about what you do or when you can actually sue an agency, because they do enjoy the privileges of sovereign immunity. And I could not support one. I know we've been discussing this for 2 years. I've been on, I think, a majority of the calls. I understand the concerns of domain investors and registrants, but here I've got to side more with an option two. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Lori. Petter.
Petter here. I'm a little bit split here. I still, from what I would like to see, support option one, because it's more of what it is, in fact. And it's also, if we choose option one, we don't give IGOs more power than other right holders, which is also something that we have heard both from the ICANN board and from other groups from GAC, that they don't like to give other IGOs too much power compared to other right holders. But on the other hand, option two is exactly what IGOs, especially from WIPO, but also from others that we have discussed this topic with, would accept, and even accept that we refer to Article 6 there in the other topic, if we use the B version here. So if we, and that's why I'm split it, if we choose the B version, then we will have a suggested solution that IGOs most likely will accept, and that could work for them. So it's a little bit of, shall we follow their lines and thereby also creating something that could be accepted in a way, or shall we follow the other line and stick to a conclusion that the IGOs don't have more protection in this way than trademark owners. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you, Petter, for that. Let me, thinking about this a bit more, no matter what we eventually decide on this split between option one and option two, I think the report's going to have to lay out our thinking on this very clearly in the final report and why we chose whichever one we chose. I also thought of one more devil's advocate argument while this discussion was going on, is that IGOs, if we recommend option one, let me tease it up by saying right now under the UDRP, if an IGO brought a complaint based on a trademark registration or a common law trademark, but trademark rights. We're really talking about such a hypothetical situation. It's hard to imagine an IGO asserting that a website is in effect imitating the IGO and confusing the public, and I'm taking out criticism websites where someone might be criticizing a UN agency and have the name in the name of the website, which would be permitted, at least in the U.S., as a First Amendment right. But if someone was just trying to pretend they were UNESCO or WIPO or the World Health Organization, it would be probably be pretty clear or not from the website if they were doing so, and the odds of an incorrect decision on that are probably very low, and a domain registrant who was actually engaged in that type of behavior appealing would be extremely low, given the costs and the lack of low probability of success. Could the IGOs make an argument that by stating that if it's appealed and the IGO asserts immunity, and many of them will assert immunity rather automatically just to not set a precedent for another situation where it could be pointed out that they didn't assert immunity, that we'd be incentivizing bad actor registrants to appeal in the belief that the IGO would be boxed in with well assert immunity, and that would vitiate the decision and allow them to retain the domain name. So that's one more devil's advocate argument we might see if we go with option one. I'm still personally divided in my own mind about which way we should go on this. Although I am very clear in my own mind that we're talking about a hypothetical situation which will be very rare if it ever occurs, where a registrant of an IGO infringing domain appeals. And I see hands up from George and Lori and Petter again. I'll call on George, assuming that's a new hand.
George Kirikos here. We've been talking about the devil's argument. I want to propose as a thought experiment what option three is, which is you get rid of the EDRP entirely. And so what would happen there? What would happen is that IGO, trademark holders, et cetera, would have to go to court. You know, there'd be no, streamlined quasi-arbitration procedure like the EDRP. People would just satisfy their disputes like they do over, copying of websites, copyright infringement, libel, every other cause of action that exists in the offline world. There's court procedures for those. They would just do the same thing for trademark disputes. That's, what my devil's argument would be for option number three. And then tying back to what Lori was saying, that that's not acceptable to trademark holders. Well, the whole reason, if you go back to why the EDRP was created, it wasn't created to replace the law. It was to create an alternate route to try to get to the same decision. And as part of that grand bargain, both sides, either side, could go to the courts to make sure that, the correct decision was rendered if either side believed that the panelists got it wrong. And Lori said she didn't see evidence of problems. We posted, mountains of evidence of cases where, a three to nothing arbitrator makes a decision, awarding a name, and then the courts give a completely different result, awarding, damages against the trademark holder who asserted the claim in the EDRP for bringing such a frivolous dispute. We're talking, the panelists getting it completely wrong. And I don't know how Lori missed that. It was posted to the mailing list. It's been posted to the chat room. So I don't know how she doesn't believe that the court system as a checks and balances step isn't effective or isn't correcting the mistakes that these arbitrators are making. It definitely exists. And so to remove that checks and balance system of the courts would be, a violation of the 1999, grand bargain that was made. And so option number three, where it just goes to the court without having a UDRP, would be, preferable to me rather than setting up a system that can be gamed by complainants. And Laura says, you know, she's talking about it, there's unique problems related to the IGOs. Well, IGOs don't have any special rules saying that if they, you know, if I throw a rock in their window, that they have to take me to a special tribunal. They still have to work within the framework of, you know, each national law. So I'm not sure, you know, maybe she wants to get on and respond to it. But if I start making UNESCO cookies, you know, UNESCO can't say, George, stop doing that, or we'll take you to the UN. There's, you know, they would have to sue me in a Canadian court. That's, you know, I just don't understand where she thinks this parallel legal system exists. And I'll leave it to her.
Okay.
To
Great. Thank you, George. I just want to state, and then I'll go on calling on the upraised hands. My personal view would be that the one option that would be unacceptable to me would be to have a registrant lose to make an appeal, have the IGO successfully stop the court by asserting immunity, and then leave the registrant without any appeal mechanism from the UDRP or URS determination. That option, which is not before us, but I just want to get on the record personally, is the one that I would find unacceptable. I'm going to ask I see Mary's had her hand up for a while, so I'm going to ask for her input before I go on to working group members again. Thank you. Mary?
Thank you, Phil, and thanks, everybody. Hopefully you can hear me because my connection is not the best. But we wanted, as staff, to address the sort of fundamental question, not so much whether option one or option two is preferable, but the connection between a successful plea of immunity by an IGO and option one, where this means, Phil, I assume the way it's written, and it follows on earlier working group discussions, that when the IGO is successful in saying we have immunity, that, you know, therefore the prior panel decision is vitiated. I think our concern here is that in some ways the plea of immunity is simply the ability, and it could be procedural or something close to it, to get something before a court. It's not the same thing as the court itself then resolving whether the initial decision was right or not, and therefore can or cannot be vitiated. So I just wanted to state for the record that in staff's view, at least at this point, having, you know, thought about it for a little bit, we are a little bit concerned at that connection being made if option one is adopted. This is not to say that we think option two is necessarily better or doesn't need more work, but we just wanted to point it out. And secondly, with respect to, I think, George's thought experiment of option three, what we wanted to point out here is that this may be actually outside the scope of our charter, which actually asks us to decide whether or not the UDRP and URS should be amended or if a new process should be created. So to the extent the working group would like to go down that path, I think we might need to go back to the council to get some better direction in that way. And finally, Phil.
Mary, can you, I lost you on that last statement. Where do you think we might have to go back to council?
If we actually pursue an option three where, you know, I know George is a thought experiment, but if we're going to recommend something about the UDRP other than an amendment or no amendment, we might need to go back to the council.
Okay. Yeah, personally, I took George's option three as just a thought experiment and not an actual proposal that we include that. I wouldn't support including that. I think we are where we are. But go on, Mary. I don't want to cut you off. I think you had more to say here.
Thanks, Phil. And that's right as well. So we just wanted to note that for the record. I think the final point was just to say that if we have time at the end of the call, if we can go back to recommendation two, because we have one additional point from the staff side we'd like to make. Thank you.
Sure. Okay. Let me call on Petter and then Laurie, and then we'll get back to Mary for that additional staff thought. And we just noting the clock, we have 9 minutes left on this call today.
Thanks, Petter. Just noting on option three, I saw George is actually waiting in the chat room. He was not seriously proposing option three. And I think that's a good decision also, but it was interesting to discuss it. Just a quick question to to the group, and but frankly, specifically to Mary. As we have a lot of plus and minus comments both to our option one and option two, do we in our initial report have to support from the group one of the options, or is it could it be acceptable if we more inform stating these two options, and then in our way also describes the minus and plus to give the public the opportunity to come back with comments that could lead us to which of them would be the best. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. And of course, I suggested that earlier in the discussion that one way we could go, particularly if we don't have a clear consensus within this working group on option one or two, would be to lay both of them out as possibilities for public comment and base a final report on the comment received. We'd have to be very clear about the pluses and minuses we see of each of them and the issues involved. Option two would involve, as I noted, issues of who would be acceptable arbitrators, under what set of rules, and who would pay, among other potential questions. I also want to note that in the chat room, I believe Jay had posited that if an IGO had brought the initial UDRP or U.S. action through a agent or a licensee, they may not have to and may not be in a position to assert sovereign immunity. In that case, we might get into the other possibility laid out in Professor Swain's paper that some court somewhere might say we're not going to hear this because the agent or licensee is not the entity that registered the trademark or that asserted the Article 6 tier right. I don't know that we should even deal with that. I mean, we can't deal in our report and recommendations for changes within the world of ICANN every potential way in which a court might deal with a de novo review and asserted claims relating to that. But I just want to note that possibility. But I think Jay is right. If the IGO protected their immunity by bringing the complaint through an agent or licensee, that might would likely prevent them from raising the issue because the party in the appeal would be the agent or the licensee, not the IGO, which would be a much more difficult argument for the agent or licensee to make to assert immunity on behalf of that that party that licensed them or that they were an agent for. Mary, what further input did staff have, and then we're going to talk about next steps and next meeting.
Thanks, Phil. And I apologize. I should have sent this note to the full working group before the call today. But in going through some of the background documentation to our work, staff came across a January 2015 letter from, I believe it was the NGPC at the time, to the GAC, which essentially says that the NGPC understands there may be differing views within the GAC about the nature and extent of IGO rights, and that some GAC members may be concerned that resolving the issue of curative rights in the ways currently being discussed, they don't go into detail about what the ways currently discussed are, but that the concern here is that this could result in the creation of new rights for IGOs. So while I don't have the information to know exactly what this was referring to, we just thought we would highlight this for the working group, certainly for purposes of recommendation two and more generally. And I will send the letter to the working group list after this call for everyone to look at, if that's all right.
Sure, sure. Yeah, thank you, Mary. I'm just guessing, but I wonder if that concern doesn't relate to concerns by some GAC members about the geographic indicator issue on an issue in which the GAC never reached consensus, and as we well know, in particularly in regard to .vin and .wine, and one reason why we have to make crystal clear in this draft report that whatever we're recommending goes only to IGO rights under Article 6 tier and does not create a precedent, in our view, for any other asserted rights in any trademark national trademark regime. Also, there's a difference, I think, between Article 6 tier, which is a Paris Convention. It's a widely subscribed international treaty, as opposed to geographic indicators, where there's no overarching global agreement on that. And finally, I noted that Lori stated in the chat that she favors IGO immunity. Well, so do I personally, but as Professor Swain pointed out, there's no clear demarcation of what the limits of that immunity is, other than it's many jurisdictions considered to be less than absolute and based on particular facts and circumstances and functions. It's 1:58. We've got 2 minutes left. Item three was working group discussion as to whether any open questions or remaining topics not currently addressed by the draft need to be included. The one I would note that if we go anywhere down the road of option two on the IGO immunity, we're going to have to give some more thought to acceptable arbitrators, arbitration rules, and costs. Cost-bearing in a final report and recommendations. I don't know of any others right now. But what I'm going to propose is that members of the working group think about item number three, and between now and the next meeting, next week, decide, please get in comments on the email list if you believe there's any other open questions. Remaining topics that are unaddressed so far in the draft report. Also, I'd invite all working group members. What we're going to start doing next week is we may circle back to these recommendations, but we pretty much adopted all but four. We still have some open issues on four. Start reading the full draft report, and is there a wiki space, Mary, where people can insert chats and suggested revisions of the language? Because I think next meeting we're going to start going recommendation by recommendation and probably just get no further than one and maybe two on the explanatory language and start working on actually editing and adding to the explanatory language justifying the recommendations. So does that seem like an acceptable way to proceed in preparation for our next call?
Phil, this is Mary.
Mary, go ahead.
Thanks. So we haven't posted this draft to the wiki. We can, and in addition, if folks would like editing rights, we can also put it in the form of a Google Doc, if that would help.
Yeah, I'd be open to that. I think that's the best way to proceed, to give people the opportunity to review it and to propose edits and additions. And then we can go over all of those starting with the next call. Because as you can see, we're now on the march to putting together a final report and recommendations. And I don't know if we'll get it out for comment before Hyderabad. That's our goal. But I think right now it's possible. It's early September, and that gives us 7 or 8 more meetings. Okay, any comments on that? It's 2:01. We're 1 minute past time. What is our call time next week? I think we're back to regular time at 12 noon Eastern. Does staff have any conflicts on that time next week? Mary's saying no. All right, so let me, Mary, let me ask this. Can staff please circulate an email after this, post this document to the wiki, create a Google Doc, and then notify staff members of the ability to please ask them to review it in preparation for our next call, where we're going to get into the explanatory language and notify them that the Google Doc is available for any suggested edits and additions. Okay, and Mary says she will do. And with that, if you have any last comments or questions, please raise your hand. Otherwise, please spend a little time on the reviewing the document between now and next week. And next week, we'll plunge into the actual language, the explanatory language surrounding each recommendation. And meanwhile, please think very hard about recommendation 4 and options 1 and 2. We're going to have to calm down on one or the other or put them both out for community comment. But we need to decide what happens where a registrant appeals a decision and the IGO successfully asserts immunity in the court of mutual jurisdiction. And with that, I'm going to bring the call to a conclusion. Thank you all for participating today. I think we made some good progress.
Thanks very much, Phil. Thanks, everybody.
Bye, all.